goes, if you know, you know, Moon Age Daydream, featuring the talents of Mick Ronson, the spider from Hull, who lit up the fabulous Ziggy Stardust shows with his dazzling guitar playing, as evident there, and powerful stage presence. The book is called Turn and Face the Strange, the Mick Ronson story. Delighted to be joined by co-authors Rupert Creed and Gary Burnett. Gentlemen, good morning. Good afternoon to you, excuse me. Good morning, Richard. Good afternoon, Richard. Good afternoon, Gary.
Good afternoon, Giles.
Yeah, good afternoon, Giles.
Good to have you with us. I mean, it's. I can't believe there hasn't been a book about Ronson already, because not only was he on some of the most groundbreaking albums of all time, but he worked on people's albums. He was a virtuoso guitar player and also a thoroughly nice chap and sort of beloved by all who knew him. Rupert.
Well, there was actually a book on Mick written by Karen Laney, a.k.a. Weird and Gilly. I think it was published early 2000s. But it's very much, they're American, and it focuses, it's a brilliant book, but it focuses very much on Mick's time touring with Bowie in the States and subsequently touring with Ian Hunter in the States. So we wanted to write a book that really combines and incorporates all the stories that we recorded of Hull people who knew Mick Ronson as a fan, as a friend, or as a fellow musician, or even, you know, as family. And so that's what we've done, isn't it, Gary?
Yes. I mean, I suppose we'll talk about the show in at some point as well. But the show Turn and Face the Strange was really what gave us the sort of momentum to write a book like this, because a tremendous amount of research had to go into that to write an authentic account of Mick's life. And then we found we had all this material, and it would be a shame just to archive it or to not put it out in some format like this. So really, lockdown was a great opportunity for us to start to think seriously about doing that. And yeah, as Rupert said, we focus on what we know. You know, we're from Hull. We live in Hull, and all of the people who work in the show, virtually all the people, are Hull people. And so we have lots of interesting and original material that perhaps had never been seen before.
Rupert, tell me a little bit about the show itself before we go into the book then.
The show was originally commissioned for Hull City of Culture in 2017. So, as Gary said, we recorded an awful lot of people's stories and memories. We audio recorded it mainly. And then because, you know, a theatre show is a duration of, what, about 2 hours, 2.25 hours, there was no way that we could get all those stories into the show. We sort of cherry-picked the best ones. The show itself has some amazing musicians, like John Cambridge, who was Bowie's drummer in the early 70s, Ched Cheeseman, who also played with Mick in the old band The Rats. We recruited these people, and then Ched in turn recruited the musicians that he thought we needed for the show. So it's a very much a multimedia spectacular with archive clips, archive photos, amazing projection by a Hull artist called Anna Bean, and a fantastic rock band and a pretty brilliant classically trained string quartet as well.
Gary, what, I mean, has Rupert done the show justice, do you think? Is there anything you want to add to that bit?
I mean, we've both been modest about the show, because what started really as a 2017 City of Culture project then became almost like a local cult following. There was lots of interest, lots of support, and lots of people demanding that we do the show again. So we took it from a very small venue called the Freedom Centre, which is quite close to where Mick is actually buried, into the large arts theatre in the centre of Hull Truck Theatre, and we pretty much sold out again, and then we did it again. We did it for two. We had a 2 week run, and then we did another run, and then we started to look at London and taking it abroad. And then, of course, COVID came and sort of put the brakes on that. But we ran again. We did it again for the fourth time. Well, the fourth time last September, and once again, you know, there was, even though we were still at the fag end of COVID, this massive interest and following. And we've got, you know, a lot of very enthusiastic people who followed us. And we thought inevitably a book would come out of this because of the uniqueness of the material. And I mean, it's just such a bloody great story. You know, it's a fantastic story.
And I mean,
we couldn't let.
I mean, Mick is tied to Hull in a way that very few other stars, because I mean, normally stars will do their, you know, lip service to where they come from and then sort of never go back. But, you know, if you look at Mick's story, he's tied to Hull and very much so. And it meant a lot to him. And I'm glad you mentioned the Rats, because people seem to think that, you know, Bowie, you know, he gave the breaks to these guys, but with Ziggy and the Man Who Sold the World. But the Rats were, you know, towards the tail end of the 60s, were a bigger thing, you could say, than Bowie. Had this sort of like one-off hit with Space Oddity. Rupert?
Well, the Rats were very much a Yorkshire band, and they were actually a covers band. Mick was absolutely obsessed with Jeff Beck, with Cream, Led Zeppelin, and they didn't do any original material. So although Mick was a brilliant guitarist and, you know, an innovator in lots of ways, it was only really when he joined with Bowie that amazing creative fertility really began to blossom, with Bowie's songwriting skills and Mick's amazing, you know, rock guitar and guitar skills, and then later on also his production skills and arranging skills. But absolutely, Hull, you know, Hull shaped Mick, you know, working class kid from a local estate, very much tied to the city. A lot of his personality, he wasn't a big eye, you know, he was very modest. Very low, not low status, but he didn't big his status. You know, he took everybody at face value, who, you know, treated everybody the same, very generous as well. And these are qualities that we recognize in our home city, Gary.
Yeah, I mean, the whole connection with David Bowie was a lot stronger than people imagine, I think. It wasn't just obviously Mick. Before Mick, it was John Cambridge, who really was the man who made the connection. With David and Mick, and then, you know, in the breakthrough, I suppose. But Woody Woodmansee, Mick Woodmansee, who came from Driffield, but was very much Hull-based. Trevor Baldo came from West Hull. And the other people as well, Stewie George, who was David's bodyguard for a long time, still lives in Hull. And there was Gary Miller, who was a producer, produced tracks on the Heathen album. It was a very strong connection with Bowie and Hull, more so than I think has been publicised. And David did actually come to Hull on a couple of occasions, once to stay with John Cambridge and once to play a gig at the university there. But the Mick, I mean, Mick's very last album, his posthumous album, was called Heaven and Hull. And Mick's sister Maggie often says that Mick would have been quite happy to just come back to Hull and work with all his old mates. People like Jeff Appleby, who joined him in Ian Hunter's band. There was this pool of people from Hull, this gallery of people from Hull, who played a big part in Mick's story. And I don't think he ever forgot his roots and the fact that he's buried where he is, and his mother lived in the same house until she died that Mick had grown up with. You know, they're a family with very strong roots in East Hull, and the whole story then has very strong Hull connections.
Yeah, and the other thing is the fact that, you know, Bowie, they then had to go to their London down south. And, you know, for people like Woody, for people like Trevor, for people like Mick, I mean, they had, if you like, it was like, you know, you could stay here and get a trade. So it was a big move to go down and basically slum it in a sort of half falling down house. I mean, they didn't move and were immediately signed. You know, Tony Visconti had some interesting ideas about what they should be playing and how they should be playing it. So it was a brave move. It was a leap of faith, Rupert, that he took, because he could have sat there and been, you know, the biggest thing in Yorkshire and done, you know, Beck covers and made a good, you know, made a comfortable probably living out of it.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing for us, the more we delved in this, is that there's actually three attempts by Mick to make it in London. The first time was in 1966, where he sort of went on his own accord and ended up in this weird cult, the Church of sort of Scientologists, with a band called The Voice. That he got very disillusioned with that. He came back absolutely penniless, heavily in debt, and he pretty much, I think, vowed never to go down again. It was then John Cambridge in 1970 got him down to meet Bowie, much against Mick's. Mick was really not very keen to do it, but John persuaded him. And so Mick met with Bowie, they hit it off, and he did Man Who Sold the World. But at the end of that period, Mick Ronson and Woody Woodmansey, they basically split with Bowie. And they came back to Hull and started a band called Ronno, which was sort of hype reconfigured without Bowie. And that didn't really work out because there was no songwriters in that band. And it was only really in 1971 that Bowie, having come back from the States, really reinvigorated and was working on the songs for Hunky Dory. And he asked Mick back, and Mick brought Woody back, and then and ultimately Trevor Boulder as well. So it took three goes for Mick to absolutely make it work as a musician in the capital.
Yeah, and I think Bowie was very good at choosing the right musicians at the right time in his career. And he knew at that point when his sort of Space Odyssey folk style songs were he'd exhausted basically what he wanted to do in that way. He needed somebody who could be a terrific rock music arranger, you know, a performer, somebody who was basically a little bit like him, a kind of a sort of surrogate, but who could lead the band so Bowie could concentrate on being the front man. And Mick was great at that. Mick was a great sidesman. And could do brilliant rock arrangements and could, you know, be dazzling on stage. And it was the right thing at the right time. I think, and as can be seen, Bowie went through lots of different musicians through his career and collaborated with all sorts of people, you know, right through the 70s and 80s and to the end, I suppose. But at the time, Mick and the Rats, because it basically was transplanting the Rats into what became Ronno, as Rupert said, and then became eventually the Spiders from Mars. It was, you know, very much similar personnel who followed, who came with Mick and made up that that composition, The Spiders.
I leapt in too early. Garrett, please continue.
I was just thinking that. Mick was quite averse to London. He could have been, he could have stayed a big fish in a small pond, and probably until today. I mean, some of his peers, for example, are still playing in local bands, and they, you know, they play weekends and they play the same sort of cover material and sort of rock standards. And Mick was obsessed with people like Jeff Beck and wanted to be Jeff Beck, but didn't have that creative muse. He needed somebody who could give him some material to work on.
But that's what Bowie did. The thing is, though, you say that, but, I mean, if you play Mooney's Daydream or the opening riff to Ziggy Stardust, people will recognise that more than they'll recognise a Jeff Beck riff, because Beck is the musician's musician. He's a brilliant, you know, he's technically brilliant, but, you know, he hasn't had the impact. Because, and let's not forget, because people go, yeah, Ziggy Stardust, but, you know, three albums worth of material in a ridiculously short space of time, pushing incredibly hard, literally recording bam 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 and touring. And if you know, Bowie's being the showman, but if, you know, Mick hadn't been able to lead Trevor and Woody as a band, and they didn't know their chops, as they call them, we would never have had the stage shows or the impact that came with, you know, with 72 and Ziggy, etc. Rupert?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a great shame, really, because Mick never made much money out of all of this. You know, he was credited on some of the albums as arranger, but he was never given a composer credit. And you think of things like Life on Mars, and you imagine that without his amazing orchestration, and it would be a pretty, not a mediocre record, but not a distinctive record. And you think of those hooks with, even back to, you know, the single Man Who Sold the World, without that brilliant guitar hook on it, it wouldn't be that great either. And I think the thing that really nailed it for Gary and me was thinking about Perfect Day with Lou Reed. you know, Mick did the orchestration for that and the piano part. And you imagine that without Mick's input. So Paul Denman, who was the bass player with Sade and grew up on the same council estate in Hull, he described Mick as a brilliant song helper. He could enhance the song, but he couldn't, you know, he found it hard to write that original material himself.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. The attempts that Mick made something original, I'll say disappointing. They're pretty average. He wrote a song, collaborated with John Cambridge on a song called "The Rise and Fall of Bernie Gripplestone," and it's okay, but it's not dazzling. There's no really, really strong hook in the way that the Bowie provided, but. I think creativity can work in lots of different ways. And I think one of the ways Mick could exercise his creativity was not by having the pressure of coming up with an original tune necessarily, but he could take an idea and really take it for a walk. So the guitar playing in Moon Age Daydream, which is just extraordinary, I think, at the end, it doesn't sound like anything else I've heard at that time. And similarly, in a song like 5 Years, where the guitar speaks, you know, it sounds like somebody's crying in anguish. And then the sort of beautiful melodic playing on something like Lady Grinning Soul or something like that. I mean, Mick had an amazing facility to help enhance music with the arrangements that he made. And I think Bowie recognised that, and he needed that at that point. Tony Visconti had left him and gone to work on with Mark Bolan, and Mick was sort of pushed to the front and said, and Bowie believed in him. He said, you know, Mick can do this. And so Mick rose to the occasion and produced what really are, I mean, in those classic albums, some of the most iconic music of the last 50 years, I think. And without him, I don't think David would have achieved that as certainly as soon as he did. But without that sort of young energy that Mick brought to it, and that experience of leading a rock band, I don't think David would have found that in session musicians and people in London. You know, Mick provided that package and he looked great on stage. And could perform on stage, and he was an experienced performer as well, which, you know, the stage shows were as much a part of the celebrity as anything else, I think.
I mean, we could say he bought into that because there's the iconic picture, isn't there, of Bowie, and everybody's seen the picture of Bowie kneeling to supplicate, shall we say, Ronson, that I think the great Mick Rock took. I mean, that's one of the ultimate images. And, you know, with, as I said before, with such a tight band, Bowie was allowed to have his stage show, to go, but unfortunately, all good things came to an end, and Bowie got more and more, if you like, distant because he had his, you know, he had his troubles, shall we say. And then, as we would see him do several times, just cut the band off and just absolutely went bang, it's finished. And for somebody like Mick, that had a tremendous impact on him. Rupert.
Yeah, but I mean, let's bear in mind that Bowie's manager, Tony DeVries, had lined Mick up for a solo career. So all this was pretty planned out. I mean, the two people who sort of lost out on it was very much Woody and Trevor Boulder, really. You know, Bowie decided that he'd finished that stage in his musical journey. He was wrapping that up. DeVries decided that, well, if Bowie's taking a break, I need someone else to make into a star. So he put all his energies into Mick. And I think the evidence is pretty clear that Mick didn't really feel comfortable, or certainly not 100% comfortable, in that frontman role. He always preferred to be the collaborator and a sideman, working with a good songwriter later on, like with Ian Hunter. But he just loved playing guitar on stage. The other thing that's worth bearing in mind is that, you know, his career didn't finish after Bowie. He went on playing with a huge number of bands and working with those bands in the studio. So he was a brilliant producer, as well as a brilliant guitarist and a brilliant song arranger.
Yeah, no, I very much support that. And I think Bowie knew his direction, he knew that he probably exhausted that that Ziggy persona and the songwriting that went with that. And by the end of Aladdin Sane, you can hear creeping into some of the songs the sort of soulfulness that would become Young Americans and bits of Diamond Dogs and everything. You know, he'd moved away from that, you know, that alien rock god. And therefore it was right and proper. It was brave thing to do, I think, when you've got something that's, you know, fizzing and successful after years of obscurity, to suddenly ditch that. But Bowie knew it was time to move on. And for Mick, unfortunately, the pressure was then landed on him, the expectation was landed on him to be much the same. And he wasn't the same sort of person. He wasn't that flamboyant and extravagant front man, but he was an unparalleled sidesman. I think one of our somebody who quoted on the book said he was the sidesman, you know, and the sound that he got was pretty, you know, unique. He had a unique, recognizable sound, and that's because he experimented with different gadgets and things and feedback and the way that he set up his guitar. But he just didn't have enough originality. And I don't think he had a heart for it as well, for a solo career. And I think he was probably quite relieved to go back to being, especially with somebody as talented as Ian Hunter, to being that sort of sidesman. But I don't think it diminishes his talent because, as Rupert said, one of the things that we discovered was that there was this incredible number of people that he collaborated with and worked with. From very sort of obscure people to people like Van Morrison. And, of course, he worked with Bob Dylan and worked with, you know, some big 90s, 80s, 90s names like Morrissey. So the career didn't stop at Bowie, but I think he quickly realised that being a frontman really wasn't him. And not feeling comfortable in that role. You know, I think he was wise to move aside and do what he was best at.
And again, I mean, the more he works with people, he's highly regarded. I mean, he works with Transformer. You know, he works with people like, you know, Van the Man, who is perhaps not the easiest man to get along with. Morrissey, you know, very much Marmite as well at that stage. But it just goes to show he's grounded, and people always said that about Mick. He always had that whole sense of humor. Let's go back to, I mean, the book itself. What are you trying? I mean, are we just, because I suppose the thing is, because we live in an age of celebrity, if you drop off the radar and you're not appearing, you know, as the lead singer, the lead guitarist, etc., people seem to think that you know you're not doing anything. But I mean, I suppose to all, you know, he was happy in what he was doing, Rupert.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and let's bear in mind he'd moved to America with Susie Ronson. You know, they married and had their daughter Lisa. And there's a brilliant Old Grey Whistle Test special with, you know, Bob Harris, where they do the Bearsville picnic, which was, you know, close in the Woodstock area. And Mick's interviewed on that, and he looks like the most chilled out musician you could imagine. He's very happy, and he's talking about, yeah, I'm popping over to London because I want to check out some new bands. But of course, he was then working with Rich Kids, with Glenn Matlock, Midgeur. And he was sort of cherry picking who he wanted to work with, and it was based on his music interest, not on who could pay the most. You know, so he carried on doing brilliant stuff. It's just that it was so brilliant in the '70s, and that it had such an impact that people tend to forget that he did fantastic things afterwards as well. Would you agree with that, Gary?
And some of the things that never really got huge publicity. I mean, we listened to some things like the Indian Summer album, for example, and it seemed as if I don't think his talent was fully realised, to be honest, in the end. I think he could have been an amazing film composer. I think he could have been predominantly a producer of new bands, and worked just as a producer, but he had this legend as being a guitarist as well. But I think, well, who knows? I mean, he died. He was 46 when he died in 1993. And at the time, he was working in Sweden with Graham Parker. I think he was touring with Graham Parker. And still busy. And But one of the things we found was that he had this tremendous work ethic, which seemed to come largely from his family, mother and father especially, were always very hardworking people. And that transferred to him. So being a gardener in Hull, for example, having a proper job in Hull was quite natural to him. He had no illusions about, you know, just sort of sitting on his bum every day and not doing anything. He had this drive and was pushed by his family to get out and earn a crust as well. So he never stopped working to the end. And I think, you know, when we look at the legacy and we actually see the number of bands he worked with and the people who talk so positively about the influence that he had upon them, it seems that his personality as well is very giving and very generous to people because he loves music. And one of the quotes we take from the show is that Susie apparently was not very happy when he turned out a very highly paid gig with Bob Seger. When he would be touring and earning thousands of dollars a week to work with an unknown band instead and for a couple of hundred dollars a week and sort of sleeping on people's floors. And I don't know if that's maybe why some people perceive he didn't fulfill his full potential, because he was driven by his love of music. And, you know, I often think that the title of that album, Plain Don't Worry, probably suits him very much. You know, that was a sort of chilled attitude. I said, just play, I won't worry. You know, the money will come from somewhere. Anyway, yes, sorry, I'll leave it at that.
It's good. That's quite all right. And also, Midgeo was kind enough to write the foreword for the book, and because he worked with Rich Kids, wasn't it, at the beginning? And that was the band that started, if you like, the whole new wave romantic movement. So again, he had that influence. Rupert, what do you hope that people take from the book, Turn and Face the Strange?
Well, I think one, you're getting a pretty well-researched and comprehensive biography of Mick Ronson, and very much that sense that the city of Hull shaped his personality, shaped his attitude, his outlook, and also his work ethic, as Gary had said. And then you get to this really quite interesting sort of combustion of these three northern spiders from Hull mixing with the cosmopolitan, bohemian, confessed at one point bisexual David Bowie. And you know, most of the time the combustion was positive. Very occasionally it turned into a bit of a firefight, you know, particularly over the issues of bisexuality and makeup on stage and glam rock at first. But of course they then could see the power that it was having, that it was a very socially revolutionary thing to be doing in terms of perceptions of gender and gender equality at that time. So they, you know, they went along with it. But there's some, you know, fascinating points where Northern Hull collides with Bowie and Beckenham, you know. And so I think what people can take away from it is a huge number of absolutely brilliant, never-before-heard stories that really illuminate and reveal the personality of Mick Ronson.
Gary, what do you hope people take from the book?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything Rupert said, but being so proud of the show and the success of the show, I think it's a terrific memento of this project now, which began in 2016, really, when we began researching and putting the thing together. And now we have here something tangible, something that people can buy and keep and remember the show by as well. But yeah, this is my journey began when really, I think Hull had just been announced to be the City of Culture 2017. And I had wanted to do something like this for ages. There was a little stage in the centre of the city at Queen's Gardens called the Mick Ronson Stage. And it was really a fantastic tribute. And I know the family weren't very happy with the idea of a statue and, you know, something, that some living testimony to the man's greatness, and that had to be some kind of live event. And so we went along. Rupert did the bid for the show. We went along to City of Culture, cap in hand, and they were really pleased to support it through a project called Creative Communities. So I've seen it go from an idea held at a relatively small venue to seeing people travel from all around the world. And I'm not exaggerating when I say that. We've had people from the States, from Australia, from Sweden and Uruguay. We had somebody from Uruguay, from Europe, from Paris, and all over the country. And I think we've got in this book, and Rupert and I are going to talk about this, but I keep hoping that maybe we could do it one more time, at least one more time.
Well, hopefully you can. If people want to find you online, because I'm going to run out of time, because I could have spoken about this all weekend. Where can people find you online, gentlemen, so they can follow you and let's get this show on the road one more time? Rupert, where can they find you?
Turn and Face the Strange, all one word, lowercase, .co.uk. You can read about the show. The Mick Ronson Story, on Facebook and all over social media. So, you can find us and we're very willing to respond.
Brilliant. Gentlemen, I'm going to run out of time, like I said. The book is called Turn and Face the Strange, the Mick Ronson Story. It's by Rupert Creed and Gary Burnett. Go and find them on the social medias. Gentlemen, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you, Giles.
Yeah, and you, Giles. Thank you very much. It's been great.